Beck to give a 50,000-foot view on the trade deadline nearly a month out. I'm JP Chunga. This is Roundball Roundup on the Utah Jazz Podcast Network, presented by First Colony Mortgage, the official mortgage lender of the Utah Jazz, and MLS number 3112, Equal Housing Lender. 12 of the last 16. Three in a row. Wednesday against the champions of the NBA. The last three were against teams with 650 win percentages. That's happened 524 times where a team has gone against those squads. And the only one to win all three, by double digits, mind you, it's a Jazz, according to Opta. Yeah, you could say it's fun. It's fun watching this team right now. It's something that I think about with this group. What does this mean for the future? How does this impact the direction of the team? It's very natural to have that as your first thought. That's why Howard's on the show. Figure out what's going on with the trade deadline. How are they going to react to this surge? Because they need this surge. The way that it started was not the way it should be going. And their reaction to that has been phenomenal. Through the same amount of games last season, Jazz were 19-20. Their record today, 19-20. And do you remember the feeling and feedback that you would get about the Jazz? People liked watching how hard they would play. People liked watching their grit, their toughness, the way they would fight. And that's very similar to what you hear this season, now at least. The turnaround has been wholesale. They were a bottom five offense and defense, according to rating. But over this 16-game stretch, it's been the 14th best offense in the NBA and the 10th best defense. 118.9 and 114.4. Finishing in the paint is better. John Schumann does the great power rankings on NBA.com. He had the stat. Finishing at the rim through the first 20 games, 54%. Over the last stretch, 60%.
A lot of it is the spacing. You know, early in the year, we were playing Walker, John, and Lowry together. I'm not sure that was the best from a spacing standpoint for the guys that were driving the ball. I think the lineups that we've put out there lately have had a little bit cleaner spacing. I think it's not just been the guards. I think Walker obviously has been able to finish pretty well around the basket with the second group. To start the game, the space has been good for guys like Colin driving the ball. Even Lowry, when he plays against a closeout or turns the corner, when John's spacing the perimeter, it just gives us a way different look. You know, I think the team has been more physical with how they've driven the ball. It's something that we've talked about a lot, is that physicality is not just on the defensive end. We've had to up our physicality on the offensive end of the floor. For the most part, it's been good lately. There have been a couple of games where we've had some slippage and have not really played in straight lines, haven't been strong with our gathers. But I think the spacing is the number one thing for me when I look at scoring at the basket. It's hard to make good decisions when the spacing isn't good.
These guys are playing winning basketball right now. Ochai Agbaji, take him Wednesday as the example. He has that block on DeAndre Jordan that gets them out in transition. When Jokic is in the game, cuts off his guy, Christian Brown, passing angle. He's trying to find Nikola. Ochai gets the steal. He wasn't the only guy on Jamal Murray, but Ochai was a part of the group that gave him a rough night. Murray has 17 points on bad shooting. Ochai had 0 points in that game, but that's definitely not the measure of what he was able to impact the game. This year is about seeing those gains and seeing the way that they turned it around, buying into roles. Who who's willing to do the dirty work. They're fun right now, and this homestand is such a good time to watch a team. They've got Toronto, LA, Indiana, Golden State, OKC, and then they're out on the road for a long time. It's fun. And I want to see if it lasts. 5 stars, nice reviews. That's all I ask of you. Let others know that you're listening to the podcast. Howard Beck, on the reaction from around the league to Utah's recent run. Plus, story time. Enjoy him. It's the Ringer's Howard Beck on Roundball Roundup on UtahJazz.com. As you talk to other people around the league, what is their reaction to the way that the Jazz are playing right now?
It's kind of funny because ever since they, you know, kind of blew it up, started over, or at least what we thought was blowing it up and starting it over by trading Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, I feel like it's this total moving target. Like, we are constantly wrong about who the Jazz are at any given moment, because it was, all right, well, okay, Danny Ainge came in, brought the wrecking ball, and they're tearing it down and they're tanking and everything. It's like, nope, not exactly tanking, overachieving, flirting with playoff berths and all kinds of stuff. And then it was, okay, well, you know, maybe they're going to do kind of this competitive middle path-ish kind of thing where it's not a total teardown and it's not a tank job. And they're going to be competitive and good, but not quite good enough. So when's the next move coming? And then there was the, wow, Lauri Markkanen, this would be last season. Lauri Markkanen, what a hot start. Didn't see this coming. Maybe you should sell high. Nope, not going to sell high. And then this season, I think I've probably written them off at least 2 or 3 times already. And then this last stretch has been really impressive. And I think, you know, a lot of this, look, this season, clearly, Markkanen had been hurt. Other guys have been in and out of the lineup. So they've probably always been potentially better than the record and the results suggested. The last stretch of games, they've shown some of that. We know they have some good players, but it is a young team and it is still a team in transition. So I think in defense of us, me and others outside of that market who might look at the Jazz and think, all right, nice young rebuilding team, not going to expect too much from them. I think they've just been hard to peg for a bunch of different reasons. Listen, in the broad strokes, the bottom line remains. They're not a playoff team this season. I didn't expect them to be. I still don't expect them to be. I love the fact that they're competitive. I love the fact that they don't want to just bottom out. But by design, you're going to end up being pretty close to the bottom anyway. You know, and by close to the bottom, you know, whatever, bottom 5 in the West, bottom 10 in the league overall, lottery team of some sort. And that's fine. This is just where they are. And they have decisions to make, which I'm sure we'll get into. But, and look, they've had some of the teams they've beaten. I was just like a week ago talking about the Jazz and saying, like, let's not get carried away. They've beaten like the Pistons a couple of times. And one of those, they were flirting with disaster. And they've beaten some other soft teams, but they've also beaten some really good teams, including last night, the Bucks. Granted, no Dame Lillard, but still, like, I'm not giving the Bucks that excuse. So there's been some impressive ones too. I can't write off the entire winning surge here when they've knocked out some of the best teams in the league along the way. So again, impressive in spurts, but you know, they are where they are.
Dallas, Miami, they beat. They took Philadelphia, even without Embiid. But for a team that in November, that I think it is fair for people to write off where they've turned it around and become a team to where they're playing watchable basketball, it has to at least be impressive to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, you know, we could caveat these things with no Lillard, no Embiid, whatever, but these are still really good teams that are established and accomplished. So I think it speaks really well of the culture that they have built or are building under this iteration of the Jazz, right? And maybe some of that's even a continuation of the culture built by Quinn Snyder during that era. But it's clear that, you know, because like you could look at a different team, like say the Wizards, where there is no culture. And in their defense, it's year one with a whole new front office, a bunch of new players. And they're in more of the extreme kind of teardown where it's like, we don't even, I'm going to say they don't care what they were getting back, but they just wanted to offload Bradley Beal. They just wanted to clear the cap. They just wanted to hit the reset button and start over. And it's a messier version of it there. But along the way, the thing you worry about with rebuilding teams, with young teams, with teams that just don't have an established pecking order, is that it becomes every man for himself. It becomes this free-for-all where guys are just out to get their stats and play for their next contract, and they're already eyeing the exits because they know that they're all just placeholders. And what the Jazz have accomplished, I think, more than anything, wins and losses aside, is that the culture is, you know, we're trying to win. And we're all rowing in the same direction. And this is not a team of a bunch of spare parts that eventually will be spun off. Side note, they probably all will be spun off aside from a few of them. But they're not playing that way. And they're not framing it that way. They are not allowing us in the public to put it in those terms because they're, as much as they may have a talent deficit relative to the top teams in the league, they're still trying to have a format and a culture and just a way of going about things where winning is still a priority, and that matters. And I think that speaks really well of the organization, and I think that that speaks really well for when you're trying to get the talent that's going to come in to help you become a high-level playoff team again. Guys see that, and I think respect it, and they probably respect, I'm just mind reading here, but if I were a player, I think I would be more intrigued by what the Jazz are building than say a team like the Wizards, at least at the moment, based on the way that those two teams are playing and approaching a similar kind of situation.
14 first round picks from now till 2029. They have a lot of optionality in the way that they approach this trade deadline. What are you hearing from people around the league about what the Jazz might do ahead of this deadline on February 8th?
I'd be shocked if they didn't do something. I think the whole league would be shocked if they didn't do something, whether that's, you know, a Jordan Clarkson move, whether it's, Kelly Olynyk, whether it's, Colin Sexton. I think there are a lot of guys around the periphery. John Collins hasn't worked out so well, if you can find a taker for him. I think, the general view is that, the Jazz aren't going to completely turn things around with a couple moves at the trade deadline, right? There's no urgency for them to figure out who they are immediately. But Danny Ainge and Justin Zanuck, I think, have shown they're always going to be opportunistic and strategic about this. And so when you're only a year and a half removed from, pushing the plunger on the last era, you're not under any mandate, I don't think. There's no urgency to, fix it all now. But I do think that, you've got certain guys who are clearly part of the future, right? Like, I don't have any illusion that they're going to trade Lauri Markkanen. I don't think they'll be trading Walker Kessler or Keyonte George. I might stop the list right there. I think those are the three that for sure you see as being part of this team for years to come. And I think that when you, however we want to frame rebuilding or whatever terms people use, you're that much ahead of the game when you've already got a Lauri Markkanen as the foundational piece there. When they made the trade, we didn't think that could be, like, no one would have said that sentence. And it's to Lowry's credit and to the Jazz's credit that he has become this player with them. And he's still in his prime. So we get caught up sometimes in these discussions of, well, what's your timeline here? And by the time they get the players to help him, is he going to age? Well, he's not going to age out. Like, he's right squarely in his prime. He'll be fine. So they could absolutely keep and build around Lauri Markkanen and have him be that foundational piece, because you got to start somewhere. If you trade him, you're just looking for another guy who's at least as good as him or possibly better. So I think with all those picks that you mentioned, all the, intriguing-ish role players that they have there, there are moves they can make, whether that's to consolidate some of the draft capital, whether it's to get other players who you think are going to move forward with Lauri Markkanen. Maybe you're just stockpiling more picks for the moment and looking to make the next big move in the summer. I think the big challenge here is you know, you're not going to use all those picks yourself, right? As Sam Presti in Oklahoma has the same problem now, right? It's a great problem to have, but it is a problem. Like, you can't use all the picks yourself. You don't have enough roster room. So eventually you have to start trading some of them. And when you have a big pile of those picks, the idea is we're in a position now to make the next blockbuster deal when another star becomes available. Cool. Great. Problem is, so are the Thunder. And they're ahead of the game in terms of their competitive timeline, right? They're already a top team. The Knicks have extra picks. Not as many, but they have picks. The Nets have a bunch of picks, including some very intriguing picks from the Phoenix Suns. And New Orleans still, I think, has a Laker pick and a Laker swap maybe from the Anthony Davis trade. So the competition for the next discontented star that everybody wants to, like, put together their big package to snag, that competition is going to be really tough. And so that it'll be interesting to see when we get to that point, right? Is somebody going to shake loose this summer? And what does that bidding war look like?
Now, let me tell you about First Colony Mortgage. They've been serving the lending needs of Utah for more than 35 years. As a mortgage banker, First Colony Mortgage offers advantages over other lenders. Not only do they process mortgages, they also underwrite, fund, and close mortgage loans all in-house. Their expert team is ready to help you with your home financing needs. Just check them out. First Colony Mortgage, the official mortgage lender of the Utah Jazz. When you consider what the Jazz got for Rudy Gobert, I have a friend, you may know him, Spence Checkitz, who says the Rudy Gobert trade was not a haul. And I laugh at that because when you look at the entire encapsulation of what they got, including Malik Beasley, Jared Vanderbilt being spun off somewhere else, they got 5 first-round picks. One of them they used on Keontae George. 1 pick swap, Walker Kessler, and Talen Horton Tucker. Now, I don't know what a haul is, but you're not getting that now with new CBA restrictions. That's not happening anymore.
I think it's a haul. I'm surprised Spence disputes that, but maybe I'll discuss it with him later this week. I'm on his show every Thursday or Friday. That's interesting. I mean, listen, I think the league thought it was a haul. I think both of those trades were pretty big hauls. And it's funny because we immediately, we do this thing, and it's not just us in the media, like it's NBA personnel who are framing it this way that we then run with, which is like, well, that sets the bar. You know, now every trade, if they got this much for Rudy Gobert.
Compared to that, yeah.
Yeah, the next team that's you know, trading their star is going to say, well, my guy's better than Gobert, or my guy's at least as good as Gobert. We should get X. It doesn't always work that way, and I think every trade, every negotiation is its own animal because the leverage points are different in every trade. The urgency of the teams involved, the timing of these trades, what you actually have available, what else some team is willing to give you. So they're, each one of them is its own thing. But I do think, like, this summer, I don't know who's going to be available. I think the whole league was focused at one point on, is Joel Embiid going to ask out? But then they got Dame Lillard and he signed an extension. Is Giannis going to ask out? But then they got Dame Lillard and he signed the extension. Is Joel Embiid going to ask out? But then they fixed the James Harden situation and Tyrese Maxey went supernova.
Yep.
And so those were the two guys. Sorry, like, I mixed them up in my head because I think I've spent so much time talking about the Embiid and Giannis. They were available until they weren't available. So those were the two guys that I think everybody was looking at, right? And especially teams like in my backyard in New York, where they're stockpiling picks. I think the whole thing was, yeah, clock's ticking. You know, maybe we get a shot at Embiid. Maybe we get a shot at Giannis. But those two situations settled down at least for now. And so the question I have, and I think this is relevant to a bunch of teams across the league, is, all right, well, if those guys aren't moving anytime soon, and you're one of those teams that's just sitting in the weeds waiting to make your move, with that really fun pile of draft picks, like, who are you making that move for? Now, as we know, in today's NBA, someone's always going to ask out. Like, the next discontented superstar is always right around the corner. We just don't know who it is yet.
Why is Mike Conley on the Wolves and not on the Lakers?
I wonder how many Laker fans are asking that question these days. I wonder if the Lakers themselves are asking that question right now. It's a really interesting question, and it's a really good question. And I, off the top of my head, you know, and trying to remember all the circumstances of last February when they made the deal, it's hard to answer. So I'll do this kind of speculatively. I'll put it that way. So the Lakers trade Russell Westbrook in that deal, right? Three-team deal with the Jazz and the Wolves.
Jazz legend
Russell Westbrook. Who could ever forget the Westbrook era in Utah? Hope everybody got their jersey when they got a chance. It's like the Rasheed Wallace jersey in Atlanta. If people don't know that reference, go look it up.
I have seen people in a zero Utah Jazz jersey here at Delta Center. So it's pretty awesome. People love it.
That's fantastic. People go look up Rasheed Wallace, Atlanta Hawks. So the Lakers give up Westbrook and a 2027 first-round pick. They get back D'Angelo Russell, Jared Vanderbilt, Malik Beasley. Of course, Conley ends up in Minnesota. The Timberwolves, very happy with this deal, I would say, these days. The Lakers, maybe a little less so. In their defense, and to try to explain the decision that they made at the time that they made it, the Lakers had a couple different problems at the time they traded Westbrook. One, Westbrook was a really bad fit with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, and their season was circling the drain. But two, when they got Westbrook, it cost them a ton of their depth. So they needed to not just trade Westbrook and unclog their offensive scheme jam and just, you know, ball dominance issues, all these other things. They needed a better fit. But they didn't need just one player. They needed multiple players. Their rotation was really thin. And so they did get 3-for-1, right? And so D'Angelo Russell, scorer, playmaker, you know, athletic, dynamic. Jared Vanderbilt, multi-positional defender, got length. Malik Beasley, presumably a shooter. Sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't. So they got multiple pieces back. And again, in their defense, not only did they, strengthen their rotation, all those guys immediately became key rotation players, but they saved the season. They made the playoff. I mean, they made the play-in, they made the playoffs, and then they got to the Western Conference Finals. So in the short term, they got what they needed out of it. And then things changed. Beasley left in free agency. Vanderbilt missed a ton of games earlier this season. D'Angelo Russell has kind of done what D'Angelo Russell has done at every stop, which is like, hey, flashes of being a really productive player, then being a really frustrating player. Would I rather have Mike Conley? Across the board, forget, like, just as a general thought exercise, you have a team.
Yes.
I'm not telling you who's on your team, who else is there, but would you like Mike Conley or D'Angelo Russell? It's Mike Conley 100 times out of 100. But again, Conley's much older than D'Angelo Russell. Conley's not much of a scorer at this point of his career. And I do think that the Lakers needed somebody at that position who could be complementary to LeBron James, but also when LeBron's off the floor or potentially hurt, which happens, somebody else who could not just run the offense, but generate offense. And I think D'Angelo Russell does that at a higher level than Mike Conley right now. But in terms of their totality, yeah, I would much rather have Mike Conley. So that's the best I could do to try to explain whatever the Lakers might have been thinking at that time.
I think of it as the sliding doors moment. If Minnesota doesn't have Mike Conley right now, where are they? They are absolutely in the dregs, because we saw it last year when they didn't have a competent point guard, when they had D'Angelo Russell next to Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns. It didn't look right.
The Wolves would be much different, and for that matter, because of that, the entire Western Conference would look much different if the Wolves hadn't been looped into that trade or smartly gotten involved in that trade and acquired Mike Conley. It's funny too, because like there aren't that many Mike Conleys out there, right? Like there's a bunch of teams where I've thought this, and in the past it would have been like, I don't know, like if they only had like Andre Miller. There's always like certain guys who are like these great connector types, and you think that team just needs this savvy, mature veteran who's, you know, over themselves and who is great at setting up teammates, who everybody loves playing with, who's a great voice in the locker room, who does all these other little things, and they don't necessarily have spectacular stats, but you just know they're essential. And Mike Conley is all of those things, right? And he's just become this essential kind of player. And, you know, look, the Timberwolves already had plenty of scoring punch, right? They've got Anthony Edwards. They've got Karl Anthony Towns. They've got a bunch of shooters. Like, their team was set up where all we needed is a Mike Conley instead of a D'Angelo Russell. Like, we didn't need D'Angelo Russell's scoring bursts. We've got plenty. We need more of a steady hand running the offense and settling guys down and being a voice of wisdom who's been around for a while. So, you know, like, Conley was exactly what that team needed. He was the right guy at the right time. And could he have been that for the Lakers? Maybe. But again, their needs were a little different at that particular moment.
Are we waiting until right up until the deadline for real moves to get made?
I don't know. It's funny. Every year around this time, you know, we all ask these questions of each other in the media, but then we're also asking, you know, scouts and executives what they think. And, you know, even the people who are driving the market, the ones who are making these deals, can't accurately predict how the market will unfold. It's a living organism, trade season, and it just kind of takes its own course and goes its own way. And, you know, I think everybody was shocked when the Knicks and Raptors pulled off that OG and Anunoby trade. I was shocked for any number of reasons, not the least of which is that the Knicks are suing the Raptors right now. But that trade landing when it did in the midst of the holidays, you know, was a pretty big shocker. And earlier than bigger trades usually come, right? We talk about trade season starting unofficially in mid-December, but you know, we don't usually get a ton of movement right off the bat. And the trades usually happen closer to the deadline. So what are we, like 3-4 weeks out now? 4 weeks, I think. My guess is we'll see most of the activity closer to the deadline. But these teams will surprise you. You know, somebody decides it's, you know, the pieces are right now, or it's become urgent. We just, you know, somebody just went down. We need to replenish. I will say this, like, as much as we've talked about the last couple of years being this incredible parity and parity making teams less enthusiastic about making in-season moves because everybody thinks they're in it, right? If you don't think you're a playoff team, you think you're at least a play-in team.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels like there's fewer sellers. This year is a little different because you've just got some situations that are untenable, right? Like the Atlanta Hawks, absolutely, you're going to make some moves. They know internally we have reached a logical end to this group. Quinn Snyder got in there. He's been there long enough to try to turn it around. Even he has not been able to fix whatever's going on there. They're going to make some moves. The Raptors have already started to undo things by trading Anunoby. No one's going to be shocked if they trade Siakam next. The Warriors are flirting with disaster right now and need to do something. Plus, Chris Paul just went down for a while with a broken hand. The Lakers, again, annual tradition. The Lakers are in crisis and need to make a move to fix things. There's too many teams that really need to do something right now for there to be a dull trade deadline. So if there's, you know, famous last words, I never want to predict these things, but I feel semi-comfortable telling NBA fans out there that they should, you know, strap in, brace themselves. I do think we're going to see a pretty active trade season. And won't we all love that? Because nothing we love more in the NBA than a transaction.
Batten down the hatches.
So I started my career as covering the Lakers back in 1997. So one of the first playoff series I covered was Lakers-Jazz. And I was new to covering the NBA period. And the Lakers at the time, their coach was Del Harris, who is just the nicest, kindest, gentlest man you could possibly imagine. And Dell was great. So he was my everyday coach voice covering the Lakers. And you don't necessarily encounter the other coaches until, especially in a playoff series, now you really are starting to cover like both teams and you're going to both practices and bouncing back and forth a lot. during the regular season, I was, you know, like 99% focused on the Lakers. And I just remember being in some gym. I can't remember where the Jazz were working out. And it being like one of my first scrums with Jerry Sloan and just how intimidating that was. Like people, the way, for fans now who aren't aware of how Sloan was, think about Greg Popovich and how intimidating he can be in some of these press conferences. It was kind of like that, except that, you know, Pop might be busting your balls a little bit and then like kind of laugh and smile or whatever. Not always, but sometimes we'll break the ice that way. I don't remember Sloan ever balancing it out. And he could be very kind too, by the way. Like, I think Sloan had a soft side for sure. But man, if he thought your question was stupid, off base, not well formulated or confusing or whatever, you were going to feel about 5 inches tall. But that's just part of the job too. Like, I don't mind that. In fact, while there are limits to this, I think the coaches that respond that way to us help make us better. It sharpens you because now you're really thinking like, all right, I not only do I not want to have a bad response and feel that way or you know, be cut down. And back then, at least there was no social media, right? So if you're embarrassed, it's only the other people who are in that scrum, and it's unlikely it's ever going to even be on TV, and there's no social media for the video. No one's got iPhones. iPhones don't exist yet. So at least the shame and humiliation is minimized. Now, like, you play this wrong, you may be going viral. But I do think that the fear of asking the wrong question of a Jerry Sloan or a Greg Popovich or just screwing it up, it makes you sharper because it makes you formulate the question better. Maybe you'll be a little bit more precise than you would have been otherwise.
I would love to see a Jerry Sloan sideline interview right now. That would be interesting.
Plenty on YouTube, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't get the same pub that Greg Popovich got when he was at his peak taking down every single sideline interview that he had.
Yeah, it's quite a reel. And, you know, the sideline interview, it's not like it was... it's been around a long time, but I think the league maybe, you know, kind of expanded on it over time. So maybe those demands are a little higher than they would have been at one point. But because I do recall when coaches first started, because like Phil Jackson, who I covered for several years, Phil didn't really like those either. Some coaches are really, you know, genial about it. And you know, it's they don't love it, but they'll play along. And obviously, yeah, some of them are a little bit more irritated by the whole process than others. And Pop has, you know, to his credit, I feel like he's lightened up. He has some fun with it. I think he likes playing the bad guy. My best Pop story real quick is that years ago, I went to go do a story. It was when they first hired Becky Hammon, and I was doing a feature on Becky Hammon, and I went down to to San Antonio to talk to Pop about it. Pop had just grown out the beard, and it was the first time I'd seen him with the beard. And he pulled aside for me, and I was going to talk to him for 10, 15 minutes about Becky. And before we started in, I just said, by the way, with that new beard, you're looking even more intimidating than usual now. Just kind of joking around. And he waves his hand and he goes, it's all shtick. And I loved that from Pop because there's a self-awareness there. And listen, like I do not envy the TV reporters who have had to go through it with him on live TV. That's tough. But especially now and for the last several years, I feel like there's a little bit of like he's playing up to his own image and he has a little bit of fun with it. So that's been nice to see.
And easy to be happy when you have Victor Wembanyama on the team, I think that helps things.
Yeah, they had several years there where there was no Victor Wembanyama, no Duncan, no Parker, no Ginobili, no Kawhi. I think we'll be seeing them bouncing back pretty quickly before too long. They could use a Mike Conley, couldn't they? Imagine Mike Conley with Victor Wembanyama. I'm telling
every
you, everybody
team,
could use a Mike
every
Conley.
Every team could use a Mike Conley. That's something that I learned on this podcast with a great Howard Beck of The Ringer. Howard, thank you so much for taking the time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.